Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
The spooks of science fiction and science fact. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. We're getting into the Halloween spirit with our annual spooky episode. And what better way to celebrate Halloween than with a spooky flick? We'll speak with NPR's critic at large, Eric Deggans, about his favorite space-themed scary sci-fi movies. Then, from science fiction to science fact, what cosmic creeps are out there in our universe? From black holes to green comets, we'll dive into the scarier side of space exploration. We'll speak with UCF's Jan Fernandez and Addie Dove and University of Vermont's Jim Cooney about our scary universe. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? It's spooky season, and one of my favorite Halloween pastimes is watching a scary movie. But I'm short on recommendations this year, so we reached out to Eric Deggans, NPR's critic at large and Knight Professor of Journalism and Media Ethics at Washington and Lee University in Virginia, for his recommendations for some spooky, space-themed horror flicks. Eric Deggans is here to share his all-time favorite sci-fi space-related movies. Eric, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you, Eric. As I mentioned before, I have been trying to get you on the show forever, and this is a great opportunity. We're coming up with our spooky season recommendations, and we've tasked you to come up with some space-themed scary movies, which I thought was going to be a tough assignment. It was not. You sent us a whole list of movies. What is on the top of your list for this spooky season, Eric?
Well, at the top of my list is the first two Alien movies, of course. These are movies combined a really interesting and innovative look at the future with all the tropes and all the suspense of a great horror film. The first one in particular, directed by Ridley Scott, Alien, came out in 1979, I believe, had a really sort of British feel to it. So the pace at the beginning in particular is very slow, and it builds throughout the film. And I think the film also benefits from what we saw happen with Jaws, where the costume that they came up with for the monster wasn't that convincing when you could really fully see it. So Ridley Scott very wisely decided to prevent that from happening until the very end of the film. So you have a lot of suspenseful shots where you see parts of it. You see the mouth, you see as it's changing, you know, it started out as a very small thing that emerges from the stomach of one of the astronauts. And that in itself, I saw it in the theater. I'm old enough to have seen it in the theater. And when that xenomorph burst out of his stomach, I had to leave the theater for about 5 minutes. I had never seen anything like that on film before. And then the second film, Aliens, takes those horror movie tropes, but weds it to a combat army military movie kind of vibe. So you have this team of Marines up against dozens of xenomorphs. There's a lot of themes that you would see in military movies like Platoon, but also a lot of horror movie tropes, because again, they're very judicious in how they show you the xenomorphs. And it takes a while before the movie even reveals to you that there's more than one of them. And all these Marines have to deal with basically a planet full of killing machines. So those are my two favorite combinations of science fiction and horror by far.
And they've led to so many spinoffs, right? I've played the game Alien Isolation, which is just as terrifying as that first film. That's that suspense. You don't know where the villain is. And also a television show, right? Which I've started watching and you recently reviewed for NPR, didn't you?
Yeah, Alien Earth on FX. I interviewed the showrunner Noah Hawley, who also masterminded FX's version of Fargo, and he's become sort of the go-to guy for translating films into compelling original TV series. And he told me before, I mean, this would have been maybe a year and a half before the show actually debuted, he told me that he was mostly going to be taking from the first two Alien movies. And I think that's obvious if you watch the TV show. The beginning of the series is very much a tip of the hat to the beginning of the first Alien movie. It starts very much the same way. And it seems to be Noah Hawley's way of sort of, you know, acknowledging the brilliance of Ridley Scott's direction and the way the slow pace that he started that movie and the way in which he introduces you to these space travelers who are working stiffs. You know, space travel has become so routine in this future that these guys are like space truckers. They're like, you know, they're working stiffs who want to get paid and they stumble on something that gets almost all of them killed. You again meet that crew again. They're very much like that, working stiffs who have been tasked to capture these deadly creatures. Several of them had already been killed by then, by the time we meet them. And then, of course, they have a horrific accident that kills the rest of them as the TV show goes forward. I don't regularly watch horror movies, so there are moments when I just couldn't even look at the screen because I was so tense and it was so suspenseful. And so I think their real success, not so much recreating the vibe of the first two movies, it was recreating that sense of suspense.
Next on your list, Eric, was Star Wars. I'm a huge Star Wars fan. Why is it on the horror list?
There are elements of sort of the Star Wars canon that again sort of harken back to what we know about horror, particularly when you think about the times when, you know, we meet Jabba the Hutt, the times when we meet some of the more exotic creatures. There's even moments in the very first one, A New Hope, they're trapped in a garbage disposal unit, Han Solo and Luke Skywalker and Chewbacca. And there's something living in there that's also, you know, trying to eat them.
I'm going to have to rewatch it through a different lens now, thinking about that. From Star Wars to Star Trek, you've got Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan on this list here.
One of the things I love about Wrath of Khan is that it was such a great rebound from Star Trek, the motion picture. There are still long stretches of it that are boring and tough to stick with, and stretches of it that where the characters, you know, they hadn't quite figured out how to play these characters in a movie. Of course, the villain of Khan and that whole opposition between him and Captain Kirk, that's wonderful. But what's best to me about the movie is that we get back to the old camaraderie between Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock and Bones McCoy. We get to see those three guys as a team, as a found family who care about each other. And in particular, of course, the bond between Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock. When Leonard Nimoy passed away some years ago, I wrote this essay for NPR where I talked about how his journey to accept playing Spock was also sort of Spock's journey to accept himself. What we see when you watch Leonard Nimoy's performance over Star Trek, the original series, and then in the movies, he also played him in some of the spinoff TV series like Next Generation. And then finally, in the J.J. Abrams movies, is a character who learned to accept the duality of his nature and to accept that being half human didn't make him less than. He was always at his fullest and his best when he accepted both sides of his nature, the Vulcan logical side and the human side. You know, Leonard Nimoy was always at his best when he accepted that he was great at playing this character. People loved this character, and he needed to lean into the way that it affected his career and his life, which he eventually did. So what I love about Wrath of Khan is that's the beginning of that acceptance.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Eric Deggans about his top sci-fi horror movie recommendations. He's a critic at large with NPR and the Knight Professor of Journalism and Media Ethics at Washington and Lee University in Virginia. Next on your list, Men in Black.
Ultimately, I think that the mark of a great science fiction movie is not the authenticity of the new world that it creates, but the believability of it, the way in which a new universe is created that you want to live in. And what Men in Black does is it takes the average sort of trope of government agents tracking down a villain, even a villain who threatens the entire world, and flips it to show you that there's this entire universe that most of the world is unaware of, that is populated with all these great aliens. The rules of how life works there is different. The rules of how law enforcement works there feels a little familiar if you've seen Dragnet or if you've seen Law and Order, but it's also very different because it's aliens. And so they have a lot of fun with taking the tropes of a typical sort of police detective drama and also an espionage drama and also an end of the world drama, and using it to serve this high concept, which is there are all these aliens on Earth that most Earthlings are not aware of. And there's a government agency that's been tasked to keep tabs on them, that is always in the corner of your vision, always on the periphery of your sight. You're never quite aware of them. When you become aware of them, they erase your memory, but they are the guardians of the world and they're the men in black. The film itself, especially the first one, has a tone and a pacing that is comedic, but also can be serious when it needs to be. It creates a universe that you want to live in and know more about. And that to me is a hallmark of a great science fiction TV show or movie.
I looked at the date and I remember being terrified because I was 10 when I saw that movie. And Vincent D'Onofrio, when he gets in that skin, like that's a very terrifying scene for a 10-year-old to be watching, right?
Hollow out people and put on their skin like he's wearing a suit. I mean, is there anything more horrifying than that? The tip of the hat at the end of the movie, which is this idea that, you know, the entire universe that we're in might just be a marble that much larger aliens use to and entertain their children with.
Yeah, there's nothing like existential existential horror, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Next on your list, Jeff Goldblum, Gina Davis, The Fly.
So this is one where it's much more a direct sort of connection between science fiction and horror, because this is, you know, of course, an experiment gone awry where Jeff Goldblum plays a scientist who invents a teleportation machine, inadvertently teleports himself and a fly, and the machine gets confused and melds the two of them on a genetic level, and then he begins to transform. Again, this is a platform to talk about all these questions that we have about, you know, what happens when we invent a machine that's so dangerous that we kill ourselves with it. Also, you know, what connects us to the world and what binds us to each other, and you know, what happens when those things are kind of severed by, you know, a sort of driving ambition that can ultimately be self-destructive. But you also get this good old-fashioned horror where, you know, Jeff Goldblum's character starts to, you know, his fingernails come off, his body transforms. Eventually, he turns into, you know, a giant fly. They figured out how to manage that transition in a way that was, that felt very realistic and also was really horrifying. If you're familiar with the early version, the first version of this movie, you know, this was a movie that was made, I think, in the 1950s.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and basically what happened was when the guy teleported himself, he had a big giant fly head and a giant fly hand. And that was their version of, you know,
not nearly as terrifying.
What happened to him. And because of the much better special effects technology, you know, they were able to make that change much more gradual, where Jeff Goldblum seems human, but then his fingernails come off, his fingers split and start to fuse, his skin falls off his body. And then by the end of the movie, you know, he's completely transforming into a giant fly and gets to the point where he begs his former girlfriend to kill him. Anyone who watches that, even now, I think, again, you know, this is a movie that holds up. You watch it now and it has the same punch that it had when it came out, and to me that's another measure of a great sci-fi.
I tried to watch all these films before interviewing you, and I'm not a huge horror fan myself, so you certainly terrified me over the weekend, so I appreciate it, Eric.
No problem, man.
Great. Eric Deggans, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Eric Deggans, a critic at large with NPR and Knight Professor of Journalism and Media Ethics at Washington and Lee University in Virginia. Still to come, cosmic terrors like ultra-massive black holes.
We had to invent a new term for that kind of black hole because it's like so much bigger than like the one at the center of our galaxy. We now call those things ultra-massive black holes.
Our Halloween-themed episode continues with the terrifying things about our universe. That's just ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space-mba.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. Two twin spacecraft are gearing up to hitch a ride on Blue Origin's giant rocket, New Glenn. The Escapade mission's two spacecraft will orbit Mars, studying things like the planet's magnetic fields and how Mars is affected by solar wind and space weather. We'll look at the mission and the future of New Glenn and Blue Origin next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about the eerie side of space. As we further explore our universe and develop better telescopes and spacecraft that can peer deeper into space, we're finding some creepy things. That includes giant pulsars and enormous black holes that are so big they need a new name. Plus, cool comets whizzing by our planet this Halloween. Here to take us on this cosmic horror journey is University of Central Florida professors Addie Dove and Jan Fernandez, along with University of Vermont's Jim Cooney. Addie and Jim are also hosts of the podcast Walk About the Galaxy. Addie, Jim, Jan, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Hey, Brennan.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Hey, always fun to have you on around spooky season for you to terrify me. I know you've been working very hard for some scary topics to discuss for this show. Who wants to go first?
I know, Brennan, that you love black holes, so I'm going to tell you about black holes first. Black holes are terrifying. Everybody knows that. And maybe on your show, you've talked about some of the biggest black holes in the universe before, but I haven't really given them much thought. And then I was looking at these things. There's one called TUN-618.
Sounds
which is
heavy.
An awesome name. If you're going to be a giant black hole, that's an awesome name to have. It has a mass of 40 billion times the mass of the sun.
That's inconceivable.
It is inconceivable. It is 140 trillion times brighter than the sun. When I say that, I mean, obviously, it's a black hole, but it has a big disk of hot material surrounding it. That's way brighter than our entire galaxy. This is just one object, and that terrifies me.
That never happens. You're never the one who is terrified. Where is this black hole?
So, it's right in your backyard, Brendan.
Okay, come on, Addie.
This thing is way far away. This is something like 10 billion light years away. I mean, it's very, very far away. Don't worry.
It's coming for you.
But still, it's terrifying that I exist in the same universe as something with that much mass. I mean, like that's just a terrifying thing. And turns out, here's the cool thing. We had to invent a new term for that kind of black hole because it's like so much bigger than like the one at the center of our galaxy. We now call those things ultra-massive black holes. And even newer things. So there's a thing, I won't go through the whole thing, but there's one called Phoenix A that we measured the mass of tentatively around 100 billion times the mass of the sun. And we had to invent an even new name for that. And we're calling them stupendously large black holes or SLABs. I'm scared. Yeah, stupendously large.
The scope of those is terrifying, but the fact that you are saying black holes as plural is also terrifying as well, Jim. How do you actually measure the mass of these things? I don't even remember what you said, but it's something like 40 bajillion times the mass of our sun, right?
40 billion, this TUN-618, 40 billion with a B. I mean, that's an insane thing. I mean, usually when you're measuring the mass of things, you look at other objects that are nearby and how it's tugging on those things, right? So the stronger your gravity, the faster things nearby will be moving around. These really, really massive ones, we have to get a little bit creative because they're so far away that you can't really see other things that are too close to them, but we're pretty clever. So, you know, if it wasn't exactly 40 billion, and don't sue me, but
close enough. Said that,
but it's in that neighborhood, which is astonishing.
It's still terrifying, even if not super accurate. Jan, I'm going to turn it over to you. You're new to this conversation. What did you bring to scare the crap out of me for spooky season?
I guess to follow on what Jim had, I was thinking about the object called Geminga. So Geminga is terrifying to me because it is actually a pulsar, and which means it's a neutron star, which means there was a supernova, and it's only about 250 parsecs away.
That's so close.
Right? That's pretty close. That's pretty close.
So it probably went supernova like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago, because the pulsar is the rapidly spinning neutron star remnant from the supernova, right? But the fact that it is so close, you can get all into all kinds of things about, well, okay, when the supernova actually did blow hundreds of thousands of years ago, was it close enough to Earth? Did it affect the environment at all? Did it affect planet Earth, right? You know, with pulsars, they have the really strong magnetic fields and there's a lot of debris and high energy photons that get shot off into two jets that go out of the neutron star. So what would have happened if Earth had been in the path of one of those jets after the supernova, right? So this object is moving with respect to the sun through the Milky Way galaxy. Obviously we're safe right now, but the fact that something like that can be pretty close and it was only discovered once X-ray telescopes started becoming a thing in, I think, the 70s, it was maybe the 80s. And because it really is only detectable.
Do we have any? So we've talked a bunch about like Betelgeuse maybe going exploding and we'll get to see it and it might go supernova. But are there other like supernovas that are closer or nearby that might have this same fate?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I mean, Betelgeuse is probably the closest one that's going to go next. But, you know, there's not that many really massive stars in our neighborhood. So we probably don't have to worry about it, right?
But Brendan still will.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I will. Thanks, Jim. Yeah. And yeah. But that actually, that's a little reassuring. I wonder if it's Jan's presentation of the information, Jim, that makes me a little more reassured.
I don't know. The fact that it's wandering through the galaxy is
that's a little terrifying.
Whenever we discover like rogue planets and other things and things wandering where we don't expect them, some of these interstellar comets and interstellar visitors we've been having, those are all a little bit terrifying in their own way because it's like, where did they come from? And have they been here for years and we haven't noticed?
Gumminga, Jan, very close. And time-wise, that's like yesterday in galactic
time, isn't
it? That's
right. I mean, it probably didn't cause a mass extinction on Earth, but because we're still here. But
the things that were here at the time maybe aren't. It's not... Yeah, where in geologic time does that sync up? Where do we have to look for that in the record?
Maybe when the supernova went, it was bright enough, it convinced our ancestors to come out of the trees and start walking around. I mean, it was probably more recent than that. It was only a few hundred thousand years ago.
Spooky and speculative. I like it, Jan. Thank you. Addy, what you got for me?
There's one thing that's just sort of like ghostly that's happening, which is why it's exciting. There's a couple of comets that are making some appearances in the night sky. One of them is Comet Lemon. Comets are always kind of ghostly apparitions in the sky. So this one is just sort of a fun, spooky.
And didn't they scare the heck out of ancient civilizations and everything all the time, right?
Yeah, because they just appear and they're big streaks and they're like relatively bright. And like back in the day when we didn't have all this light pollution, they would have been even more obvious, right? Like, and this one, Comet Lemon, this one has like a 1,000-year orbital period. We're seeing it now and probably folks a long time ago saw it, but we haven't seen it. None of us will see it again.
That we know of unless we come back as zombies, right?
Sure. I think that there's another one though. It's Comet Swan is also in the sky in the near time. So those are kind of fun, like sort of spooky, ghostly apparitions. Comet Lemon will be sort of greenish too because of the different emissions and how it gets illuminated by solar wind interactions. And then the other thing that this is not something, I was looking to see if there were any newish articles about this, but one of the sort of scarier things that we were just talking about is like things we find that we didn't expect to see that sort of pop out when we look with a different wavelength or we look with a different camera or something like that. And since JWST has been looking at things in the sky, we've actually been finding things like galaxies, like dwarf galaxies, but also larger galaxies that we didn't expect to see. And they just sort of appear like you're looking in the sky in one area of the sky, you're like, I'm going to go study this area of the universe and these galaxies. There's an example of this when they were doing it with the Pearls Project, which is a fun name. Probably clutched their pearls when they discovered these objects. They were just looking at a certain area of the sky and they found these ultra diffuse galaxies that are very sort of faint and some small dwarf galaxies that just appear in some of the imaging. And it's sort of one of those things where you don't expect to see it. It has some different characteristics and it's not necessarily interacting with other galaxies. So it's sort of one of these rogue events where they're sort of off on their own doing their own thing and we didn't expect to see them.
Also kind of existential too. I mean, that just means that we are even smaller and less significant if there are more and more galaxies that just keep popping up, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And they've existed throughout the history of the universe because some of these were looking pretty far away, pretty far back. And so, yeah, we're finding them. There's been all of these things throughout the history of time.
That gets me thinking, you know, Jan mentioned that just since the creation of X-ray telescopes, have we been able to see certain things? We're talking about JWST that's revealing these rogue galaxies. You know, now that I have the three of you here, in the next year or so, what are you most excited for in the future of kind of astronomy and exploration?
The Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, I think that's going to launch in the timescale of a year. So that's going to be a very nice facility, but it will be doing wide field infrared mapping of the whole sky, going and doing galaxy counts, some insane number of galaxy counts in the infrared. It's similar to James Webb in that it's an infrared telescope in space, but it's different in the sense that James Webb likes to focus on a very, very tiny patch of sky at once, whereas with the Roman telescope, it will be covering a gigantic field of view at every at every shot. And so it will cover the sky, be much more efficient at mapping everything in the sky. And so
we'll
the
find
galaxy,
all the things.
It'll find all the things. It'll find many things going back across the universe. And it will, I'm sure, find many unusual things that we don't expect because, I mean, especially in the infrared. The infrared is...
Here's a good spooky one, Brendan, because infrared is like sort of like when you're out looking around and it's at night and you're like, oh, there's nothing out there. And then you put on the night goggles or infrared goggles and you're like, oh my God, what is that?
Oh, there's stuff.
That's what we're going to be doing.
Excellent. Okay. Terrifying. Jim, what are you excited about?
Yeah, I was going to say, we seem to be in the age of, in the golden age of these like mapping things. Nancy Roman is one, and the Euclid, which is a European Space Agency telescope, just launched in 2023, I think, or started in 2023. And they're just now dumping out huge amounts of data and doing the same thing. It's actually often called the dark matter telescope because it's like, which is kind of spooky, right? It's mapping the entire sky. And we're now finally getting a really good understanding of what the structure of our local, when I say local, I don't mean in our galaxy. It is a really cool time to be someone who cares about your place in the universe because we're finally getting these beautiful whole sky maps. And it really is cool. Like you have a backyard telescope, you're seeing the same thing that everybody 100 years ago saw with the backyard telescope. But with these awesome new technologies, now huge numbers of awesome things
incredible.
Are coming out.
Addie, what are you most excited about?
Yeah, I'm going to bring it much, much closer to home and much sooner. So in theory, there's a launch. So the new Glenn rocket is supposed to launch later this year, like maybe in a month. And it's going to carry on at this mission called Escapade, which is a mission that's going to Mars. And it's going to look for how the atmosphere is escaping, right? So Mars is had a great history, or maybe it had more water on the surface, and maybe it had a little bit of an atmosphere for a while, but now it's desolate and it's lost its atmosphere and it's all escaped. And we can't survive there on the surface, but we want to learn more about that. And so part of that is studying how it's currently losing its atmosphere, how it interacts with the sun, and how the sun has stripped off its atmosphere. And so, yeah, so I'm excited for that mission. And it's a cool little spacecraft that's sort of been delayed. So it'll be cool to see that go. And it's on a new rocket.
Lots of cool stuff to look forward to that is only slightly terrifying in the new year. So Jim, Addie, Jan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Thank you so much.
That was University of Central Florida professors Addie Dove and Jan Fernandez, along with University of Vermont's Jim Cooney. Addie and Jim are also the hosts of the Walk About the Galaxy podcast. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook at @AWTYSpace. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, well, reach out to us. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.